For some people, making art is a way of life.
I can't remember a time when I wasn't drawing. I can't not draw. That is just how I relate with the world.
This is Molly Crabapple. She's an artist and a journalist, and she's been making art her entire life.
When I'm happy, I draw. When I'm sad, I draw. When I'm bored, I draw. It is just, it's my language.
And the thing is, we all start out that way, right? I mean, pretty much from the time we can walk, we're scribbling with crayons and magic markers. We draw stick figures with giant heads and big, fat, happy, smiling suns. We cover sidewalks with chalk. We fill whole notebooks with dragons and fairy princesses and mean, angry monsters. But then for some reason, somewhere along the way, most of us just stop. We seem to lose the impulse to make art. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, what can we learn from the people who didn't stop?
The drawing, the act of that discipline is like a life preserver. It's like, even when you're physically beaten down or even when you're depressed or anything, if you can just hang on to this, you can hang on. That discipline can be the most powerful thing in the world.
For Molly Crabapple, art is a political tool. It's a form of action, even a kind of investigative journalism. With her pen and her sketchbook, she's documented the Arab Spring, the war in Syria, court proceedings at Guantanamo. Her work has been published in Vanity Fair, Vice, and the New York Times, and it also hangs in the Museum of Modern Art. Her new memoir, Drawing Blood, is the story of how she came of age as an artist and as a radical.
I had been protesting for a long time. I come from a very political household. I spent a lot of time protesting against the Iraq War. But there is a sense with those Iraq War protests that even if we had 500,000 people on the street in New York, this was absolutely futile. Power could have shrugged. It did not matter. And with Occupy, this was something that was actually threatening to power. Even though there were many, many less people, this was something that actually presented a challenge. And knew it presented a challenge because cops were pepper spraying people in the face all the time and kettling them and arresting them for nothing.
And this was the early days of the Occupy movement, and you were living across the street from Zuccotti Park at the time.
Yes. And I was like, these people are being so brave, and they're standing for things that I agree with. And my first sort of thing, forays, were that they had these bail funds for live streamers and journalists who had been arrested, and so I started just selling my work to raise money for the bail funds. And then I also started documenting the protesters there. And it was because, like, the media had this caricature of it where they were like, oh, these are just flaky hippies, spoiled kids. They don't know anything. And then I go down there, and it's a bunch of union guys and grandmas and, you know, veterans. And I'm like, this is a lie. This is a lie that is being told in the media about it. This is a slander. And so I wanted to use my art and use my platform to show the people who are actually there.
That's interesting because, you know, this is the iPhone age. That protest is, you know, probably one of the most photographed in history. The internet is full of thousands of images of it. What can an artist, what can a sketch or a drawing add?
This is something that gets so to the core of why I do what I do. Because I sometimes, you know, as an artist, you think, what is the point of this? Am I like, just doing some sort of obscure hobby like blacksmithing or whittling or painting china? Is this just like my quirky little craft that I do to keep myself busy until I die? Like, why am I doing this, man? And I think that in a world where every event, as you said, is so documented, where every time a cop beats someone up, there are 25,000 pictures of it, that what those pictures do, in addition to all the positive things that they do, is that they can make people numb. It's like an information overload. And so art has the advantage of being slow, right? Like when you take an iPhone picture, it's half a second. When you do a painting, it's a month maybe. And by imbuing something with your attention in that way, you're telling everyone else that they have to imbue it with that same sort of attention.
Do you have visual memories that come to mind? You know, if I just name a protest, I don't know, Istanbul or Athens, Syntagma Square, are there visual memories that just jump into your mind?
In Istanbul, the protest that I was at was by soccer fans. Now, a lot of the soccer fans, they're, you know, organized into local leagues like Galatasaray or Fenerbahce or Çarşı, which is the fan group for the Beşiktaş team. And during the Gezi protests, they were extremely political. They formed the front lines of the protests. They were astoundingly brave. And so this protest that I went to, it was entirely soccer fans from all of the different leagues. They're there with their colors. And the police have sort of had like a confrontation with them, and the police have their big water cannon. And the guys have like masked up. They've put their team mask, their team scarves. They wrap them around their face. And this one guy is just like standing in the center, and he's holding a flare in his hand. And I mean, it's just like this classic pose. Like it's the same pose that the Statue of Liberty has, you know, the one person with the torch. But it's this young member of Charshi holding up a flare with his face all masked up while they chant "fuck the police."
Is there a relationship, do you think, between art and activism?
There can be. I think it's not a surprise that many artists are attracted to ecstatic protests because those do have that magical element. Of course, so much of the best activism is actually the very boring organizing that us artists have routinely been quite bad at, but that's actually the sort of thing that creates the machinery for change. But I mean, art can be activism because art can be about every single human experience. Art can be about love and war and hate. Art can be kissing the ass of some like rich oligarch in order to get his money. Art can be about making a gesture in support of striking steelworkers. Art can be anything because art is a means of human expression.
Because we were talking about ecstatic protest, and I guess what that line suggests to me is the joyousness of protest, which, reading your chapters about the Occupy movement, it just seems like there was a lot at stake and there was a lot of anger, but it also seems like for you in particular, it was a kind of joyous time. Your life was full of friends who were coming and going, and it was a protest, but it was kind of a party.
I think that's something that's very in common to people around the world. I have friends who were very involved in the Egyptian protest, many of whom have been forced to leave the country since. And they describe it pretty universally as the greatest time in their lives.
Is that a good thing or not a good thing? I mean, is there a danger of idealizing what was actually a really pivotal political moment?
If your politics doesn't have joy, what sort of world are you building? I mean, it can't only be about joy, but if it doesn't have joy, then I don't know what you can possibly construct without that.
Yeah, what's the Emma Goldman line? If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
Exactly.
So your book begins and also ends at Guantanamo, sitting in courtrooms, watching trials, visiting prisons. What are your main memories? What images hit you most strongly during your time at Guantanamo?
Oh, there are so many. I went to Guantanamo twice. One was for the pretrial hearings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then one was for the little Potemkin tour of the prison. The thing about Guantanamo is the place where our fetishization of the ideal of freedom smacks most brutally against the various ways that we have intensely violated that. I mean, Guantanamo is a place where 800 men have passed through, only 7 of which have been found guilty of any crime, whose motto is honor bound to defend freedom. And it's written everywhere. You know, freedom, 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 defend freedom. You know, this is like the chorus of Guantanamo Bay. And this is a place where...
It's a prison.
When I was there... Yeah, it's a prison. And it's not just a prison. It's a prison for people who haven't been charged with anything. And when I was there, the majority of people were hunger striking because they wanted... They wanted to know how long they were going to be there and when they were going to see their families again. And so because of the hunger strike, they were being shackled to a chair twice a day and having a tube forced down their nose into the stomach and having protein shake pumped through the tube. And they were doing this in buildings that were labeled honor bound to defend freedom.
Did they take you on a tour through the place? I mean, did you see that chair?
They did. They took us to the hospital. And this was what was so disturbing about Guantanamo. It's this mutilation of language that happens there. So they take you to the hospital and there's the force feeding chair and the tubes and the whole setup. And there's this very like handsome doctor who, because people don't use their real names there because of security, all of the doctors had been given Shakespearean pseudonyms. So there was like Nurse Juliet and Dr. Mercutio. And I believe it was Dr. Mercutio, he is passing around this tube that they shove through men's noses into their stomach. And he's like, oh, it's such a small tube, you know, and this is a legitimate medical procedure. It's called E-feeding. And they would not use the word force feeding because they know that everyone knows that. And so they tried to make up another term for it. And everything in Guantanamo is like that. It's not, you know, locking people up forever without charge. It's, you know, indefinite detention. It's not torture, enhanced interrogation. It's not shackles. It's humane three-point restraint. Every single thing not only is horrifying, but it has this Orwellian language overlay to it.
So what art did you make out of your visit to Guantanamo?
I just drew daily life as best I could there. And one of the things that I had a real advantage of as an artist is that there's really strict censorship there. So if you're a photographer, they'll give you all these rules of what you can and can't photograph. Like you can't photograph anyone's faces. You can't photograph a certain number of doors. You can't photograph a certain number of cameras, of walls, whatever. You know, before you know it, the only thing you can photograph is the floor. And it's really, really hard to get good photos of Guantanamo. I think, you know, many people may have noticed that there is a paucity of great photojournalism of Guantanamo. And it's not because many great people haven't been there. It's just because the military looks through your phone and will delete things from it. So because I'm an artist, when they told me, like, oh, you can't draw people's faces, I just drew these, like, masks where their faces were. Because I wanted to make the censorship very explicit. I wanted everyone to know that I was being censored.
So what are you working on now?
It's funny. I've been on the road so much with this book and with, like, journalism stuff that I've really, really, really missed all my friends. Yeah. And so they're kind of obsessive. I do, like, a ton of little portraits of them, usually on, like, just, you know, the junk paper you pick up on the road, like receipts or plane tickets or hotel stationery. And then I collage all that as a background. And then I do these, like, giant paintings of them on top of it. And then they write on top of that. So it's like this attempt to get their soul. And it's really because I miss them, because it's like my last piece was, like, on the Istanbul bombing. Like, I'm doing, you know, kind of depressing stuff. And I just, you know, want to do something that's about, like, love.
Molly Crabapple is an artist and writer. She's a contributing editor for Vice, and her work is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Her new memoir is called Drawing Blood,